6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level.
You're listening to A Public Affair. I'm Karma Chavez, your guest host for today. You are undoubtedly sick of talking about, hearing about, and thinking about Tuesday's election, and likely you and many of your friends have several narratives about what the various results mean and where they will take us in the coming months and years. For most of us, those opinions are based on a combination of our emotional responses and political leanings, our reading and watching of news reports, commentaries, and blogs, and our basic understanding of historical trends. Few of us have the unique position of having been both a member of the media as a journalist, a trained political scientist who studies elections, and an academic in one of the world's greatest journalism schools. Lucky for us, just such a person is a recent transplant to Madison. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Wagner, assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike's work is motivated by the question, how well does democracy work? And he's been very busy answering that question. Since completing his PhD at Indiana University in 2006, Mike has completed one co-authored book, Political Behavior in Midterm Elections, with Elizabeth Tease Morse with CQ Press, and he has three forthcoming edited books, one with Edward G. Carmines and Michael J. Ensley called Beyond the Left-Right Divide, How the Multidimensional Character of Mass Policy Preferences Affects American Politics, under contract with University of Chicago Press, another with Edward G. Carmines and Jessica C. Garrity, Congress in the Public Mind, with Cambridge University Press, and Political Behavior in the American Electorate, with CQ Press, also with Elizabeth Tease Morse. Mike's published numerous academic articles, he's a regularly consulted expert for news outlets around the U.S., and he keeps the very smart and insightful blog, ProWag, which can be found at prowag.wordpress.com. He's working on several current projects, some of which I hope we can talk about, which include how people connect their religious views to their political preferences, the public consequences of political vilification in politics and the media, and the influence of public opinion polls on public opinion itself. Prior to going back to school, Mike worked as a journalist in Peoria, Illinois, and Omaha, Nebraska, and prior to that, I have to say Mike was a nationally renowned public speaker on the college speech circuit. Mike and I met in the 90s when he competed for the University of Nebraska and I competed for Hastings College. He was a couple years older than me and truly a role model for how to talk pretty, as we used to say, and also with his intelligence and ethics. Mike has recently come to Madison after being a professor at his alma mater, the University of Nebraska, for several years, and we're lucky to have him here with us to talk about elections, democracy, and the media. Mike, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So I'd like to start talking a little bit about your research.
Sure.
I mentioned the basic question that drives your work about how well democracy is functioning, but I wonder if you might start out by talking more concretely about how you've gone about answering that question.
All right. So most of what I do takes a look at the ways that people connect to their political leaders and whether that connection has anything to do with what happens in society. So I look a lot at what political elites say and how they frame issues and how they try to appeal to different kinds of constituencies. And then I try to find ways to connect what they say to what people think is true, what they know about politics, whether they participate in politics, who they might vote for, what their preferences are about issues, and those kinds of things. So a lot of what I do tries to connect what politicians say to the people. And so necessarily a lot of that is focused on the news media because people generally don't meet the president. They learn about what the president is doing from the news media directly or indirectly via social networks of folks that they know who either are political junkies or people who might connect on Facebook or Twitter or some other kind of social media outlet or just their friends and neighbors in their regular lives. And so I'm kind of interested in the dynamic relationship between what politicians say, what the people, how people respond or whether they respond, and how that influences how elections work, what policies get passed or don't pass, or make the agenda or not make the agenda, and things like that.
Okay. And when you say political elites, you're primarily just referring to politicians themselves? Or
mostly partisan politicians, but also members of interest groups, some religious leaders, some business leaders, some military leaders, some community leaders, but folks who are important enough to the news media to get news media attention.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And as you just mentioned there, one of the issues that you've paid a lot of attention to in your work is the question of partisanship.
Right.
And I wonder if you might start out by telling us how scholars understand that word, if it differs at all from popular understanding. And then if you can talk about the development of partisanship itself within U.S. politics leading up to what would appear to be a fairly partisan or polarized electorate today.
Right. So there are kind of two schools of thought about what political partisanship is in political science and other social scientific disciplines. And so some folks look at it as a sense of almost what one group of scholars calls a tribal belonging. So it's your team, your group, and you then see the world through partisan colored glasses, which is to say, if you don't have an opinion on an issue, you might look to your party's view to develop that opinion. When people attack your party, you find good ways or bad ways, but ways to argue back and counter-argue claims that are made about why your party might be less than stellar. And so that view argues that your political partisanship, the political party with which you most closely identify, is fairly stable over your life. And you're not very likely to change it. And knowing nothing else about you, age, gender, where you live, what you think about, knowing your partisanship predicts your vote correctly more than 9 times out of 10. And so, one takeaway from this line of research is that when you're at a party and you hear someone say, "Oh, I vote for the person, not the party," you more or less know they're a dirty liar. That's not the case. And so for most people, most of the time. And so that's kind of one school of thought. People see the world through partisan colored glasses. They don't update their preferences. They've picked their team, usually because that team, that party, has some kind of underlying set of core values that you identify with over what the other party offers. Could be because your parents were of that party, or your social group when you came of age politically were of that party. But you develop your partisanship, and you generally stick with it through most of your life. The other school of thought is that people kind of subconsciously are constantly updating their attitudes. And so they say, well, gosh, I think that the government should spend more of its resources protecting the environment and expanding women's rights and creating a larger social safety net. And it looks to me like the Democrats are more interested in that than the Republicans, so I am a Democrat. But if they then see Democratic administrations or a Democratic Congress pay less attention to those issues, they might say, well, gee, maybe I'm an independent. Or they might look to another party to shift and change what they're in. So this is the running tally perspective of partisanship. So you have the kind of unmoved mover, I'm a partisan forever perspective, and then the I'm constantly updating my attitudes, and if there's some tipping point that I reach where my party has just done enough stuff that I don't like, I'm either going to call myself an independent or maybe even just switch over to the other side. And so those two perspectives have kind of competed in scholarly circles for 5 decades or so, and both conclude broadly that the public is polarized. And this is where some of my work with Ted Carmines and Mike Ensley comes in. And so a lot of evidence suggests that during the 50s and 60s, Americans were broadly de-aligning, which is to say they weren't as strong partisan identifiers. They participated more in politics. They knew more about politics, and it was a less polarized time. And the mistake that scholars made broadly was to think that this was always the state of things, when in fact it was just, it's kind of the drunk looking for, his or her keys under the lamppost because that's where the light is. And so the first time we turned on the light, with good survey research was in the 1950s and 60s. And so the first data we got was during a period of de-alignment. But if we look back to congressional voting records from the beginning of the Republic to now and how things look now, we see a much more polarized time. And the 50s and 60s were unique in that the parties in Congress weren't as different from each other as they are today. And a lot of that was swallowed up by white Southern Democratic elected officials being conservative on racial issues. And so they were closer, more conservative in that respect, and Northern Republicans being more liberal on racial issues. And so once the parties sorted themselves out on where they stood on civil rights and states' rights, the polarization of the 1860s, the 1890s, the 1930s, the 1790s, that returned again, and we've got a really polarized Congress today. The question is has the public followed them? And there's quite a debate. Some folks, the most prominent of which is a guy at Emory University named Alan Abramowitz, argues we're deeply polarized. He wrote a book, a good one, called The Disappearing Center. Fewer people are in the middle, more people have chosen, a team. And then the other argument comes from Mo Fiorina at Stanford, who wrote a book called Culture War? Question mark. You know, saying there's not really a culture war going on. Most people are in fact moderate, and there are, you know, a lot of people out there who are deeply, deeply rabid partisans, but they're not that many as compared to the people who are in the middle. And what Ted, Mike, and I's research shows is that who's right depends upon how people locate themselves in terms of two broad kinds of issues that they care about. So on the one hand, people have preferences about economic issues. How much should the government be involved in managing the economy? Should the government provide a welfare state? Should the government provide education benefits? Should the government be involved in the provision of health care, you know, Social Security, those sorts of things? And then there's also issues that have especially been prominent since the Roe versus Wade decision of just social issues. So should the government legislate morality? Should the government decide whether a woman can have an abortion? Should the government decide who can get married? Should the government decide whether they put their citizens to death? You know, all of these issues have really come up again since the 70s, since Roe versus Wade, since the Supreme Court reinstituted the death penalty, those kinds of things. And so people can have attitudes on those two broad kinds of issues in a variety of ways. They could be liberal on both, right? They could say, let's tax the wealthy and pay for social programs, and let's have a woman's right to choose and same-sex marriage. So these are liberals. People who are just the opposite are conservatives. But there are almost as many people who are on what we can think of as the off-diagonal. So there are some people who say, I want the government out of my life. Don't take my money in taxes and pay for social programs, and don't tell me what to do in the privacy of my own home. So these are libertarians. And then we have their converse, you know, communitarians, people who say the government should manage the economy and provide a strong welfare state and legislate a Judeo-Christian morality that, you know, outlaws abortion, outlaws same-sex marriage, you know, and that kind of thing. And then there are, you know, a few people who are just honest to goodness in the middle or could care less and just don't think about it. And so the people who are polarized are the liberals and conservatives. The people who are on the off-diagonal, the libertarians and communitarians, are just as divided from each other, but they've got no home. They've got no party that represents the totality of their views. And so these are the swing voters in every election. Mm-hmm. You see Republicans trying to appeal to libertarians on economics and communitarians on social issues. And Democrats do just the opposite. And as it turns out, libertarians tend to be more educated and wealthier, which correlates to greater political participation. And so libertarians participate more, communitarians participate less. And so elections often turn on whether Democrats can convince libertarians on social issues to vote for them, or Republicans can convince libertarians to vote for them based on economic issues. And so some of us are deeply polarized, are liberals and conservatives, and participate a lot and aren't changing our attitudes probably no matter what, and others are stuck with their views on issues that just don't reflect the menu that the two parties are offering. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where the polarization debate, at least in our view, stands today.
If you're just joining us on WORT's A Public Affair, we're talking with Dr. Michael Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, about elections, democracy, and media. The number to call in Madison if you'd like to join us is 608-256-2001 or toll-free 866-899-WORT. Now, I was intrigued by one of your articles on the issue of partisanship that I wanted to ask you a little bit about as it relates to this seemingly maybe most partisan issue of abortion in terms of social issues. In your co-authored piece, How Abortion Became a Partisan Issue.
Sure.
Now, you and your colleagues contend that this was not always as clearly partisan as it is today.
Right.
So can you talk about that?
Yeah, so when abortion politics began getting discussed in a public way in the 1970s and 1980s, some of the most prominent supporters of the choice position were Republicans. You know, ironically now, an Oregon senator named Bob Packwood, who is a Republican, got an award from NOW for his progressive view on the abortion issue, and then later left office in disgrace for sexual harassment problems. You know, and so it's kind of interesting that, you know, NOW's first kind of public pronouncement of thanking a politician on the abortion issue was to a Republican. The first president on the Democratic side to run for office after Roe versus Wade was Jimmy Carter, who was an evangelical Christian who said, I personally oppose abortion. He promised and pledged when he ran for office that he wouldn't follow his own personal views politically and held true to that pledge. But, you know, since then, there has not been one Republican candidate for president who's had the pro-choice position. Or, I'm sorry, yeah, there has not been one Republican presidential candidate has been pro-choice, and there has not been one presidential candidate on the Democratic side has been pro-life. So since 1980, the parties at the presidential level, the guys who've won the nomination for office, have always been pro-choice on the Democratic side and always been pro-life on the Republican side. And how did that happen? It wasn't obvious that that had to happen. Traditionally, the Republican Party was the party that said, keep government out of my life. And so what happened? Interest groups got involved on the issue. And since the Democratic Party had been appealing to women on other issues, what were considered women's issues during times of being less traditional for women to work outside the home or work in professional jobs outside the home. And so Democrats often appealed to women on children's issues and health care and things like that in the 60s and 70s. And so they were already a more natural demographic constituency for the Democrats. And so Democratic interest groups started to pressure Democrats to be to adopt the choice position on the abortion issue. And at the same time, a woman named Phyllis Schlafly, who, of course, you know, many of you might know as the kind of the person who led the fight against the Equal Rights Amendment with Stop ERA and that interest group, which later became the Eagle Forum, which was an interest group on the other side pressuring Republicans to say there are plenty of people out there who don't support that choice position and you all should take the life position in the Republican Party. And so these kind of NOW and NARAL, now it's NARAL, Pro-Choice America, the National Abortion Rights Action League, kind of were fighting against the Eagle Forum and some other interest groups on the right, pressuring the parties to take positions and giving money to candidates in primaries who were on that position. And slowly over time, the party started electing people who sorted out on that position in a way that they hadn't before. And I think that's one of the reasons we have our contemporary abortion politics today.
Yeah, it makes sense. Mike, actually, we have a caller on the air.
Great.
Caller, if you could state your first name and your question.
My question is, when you were talking about people like libertarians and so forth, you're talking about whether they support social programs more than they do economic programs and so forth and so on. My question is, it depends on the amount of money that the people get, right? In other words, if you're moving into the middle class or upper middle class or the millionaires and the billionaires, your attitude is a hell of a lot different than if you're a worker who's making minimum wage, or if you're somebody who doesn't even have a job. And my question is, isn't that one of the lines, other than the other social issues that you were speaking about, that the parties have? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Thanks for the program.
Thanks so much. Mike?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So there's a lot going on there, and I think they're all really important and interesting points. And so on the one hand, when we just look at the demographics of people who have issue preferences that are libertarian, they tend to be wealthier, which isn't to say there aren't any working class libertarians. There are, but they tend to be a little bit more financially well off and more educated. And so they weight their economic preferences a little more heavily on average than they weight their preferences about social issues. And so that has something to do with why libertarians tend to break to the Republican Party. I think the general correlation between people's economic issue preferences or the social issue preferences, the economic one drives their partisan choice to a greater degree than social issues. Social issues are becoming more important, but economics still kind of drive that behavior. But of course, one's own social position, you know, where they are in terms of their socioeconomic status, their comfort in their community, that kind of stuff, as you, I think, suggest, are important factors to consider as we try to figure out who's where in the American political landscape.
Cool. Great. And I think we do have another caller on the air right now. Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Hey, my name is George. And I was intrigued by your comment about the senator from Oregon, Packwood, supporting abortion at the time. And it brought back some thoughts that I'm not sure are correct or not. Maybe you can help me out with that. I think that the Republican types that were not opposed to abortion at the time of Roe versus Wade, which was just in the week of of it being illegal, you know, because when it was illegal, there was a lot of harm that was being done to innocent people,
right,
as much harm as the current debate is. So I seem to recall that the Republicans of that era were also people who would be supporting eugenics, you know, the science of selective death, I guess is the way, best way I can put it. Or they would also be supporting selective genocide. And that seemed to be me, to be what I recall about the support. They were supporting abortion. It wasn't the part of the debate that we're having right now. So, and then I think that because a more libertarian point of view on abortion, being the woman has the right to decide her or herself, was what was the real breaking point between the between those two camps. So maybe you could help me out with that. Thanks.
That's an interesting question. So in terms of the research I've done, and so what we did was we coded articles that appeared in Newsweek magazine and the New York Times that mentioned the word abortion from 1975 to, I think, 2008. And so we didn't see much evidence of elected officials talking about eugenics or sex selection or other kinds or other kinds of reasons that one might choose to support abortion rights that we don't see much talk about today. But there was a small strain of public intellectuals who made that argument during some of those periods. And there's also been evidence by some more controversial social scientists in more recent years who have made the argument that the more abortions in an area, the less social ills. And so that's been a really controversial argument that some folks have made. I can't remember. I think it might actually be a part of the Freakonomics book. There's some correlations that those economists run that talk about some of those kinds of things. But that conversation, in terms of partisan politics, wasn't much of the conversation about abortion during that particular time. Part of it had to do with women's rights. Part of it had to do with the growing power of the Christian right, and most notably in the late 70s and early 80s, the Moral Majority led by the Reverend Jerry Falwell, and then the Christian Coalition led by Ralph Reed. And they certainly weren't talking eugenics or anything like that. They were talking a woman has a right to life. And so the dominant frames that we saw emerge by the mid-80s really lined up to whether or not a fetus is a person and whether or not a woman has a right to control her body. And so those were the two major arguments. But it took a while for those to develop. And so, a smarter person than I am or a more ambitious person than I am could probably look at more media outlets than just the two that we did and try to investigate what you're talking about a little more thoroughly.
Well, and it's interesting, Mike, if I'm remembering correctly, it seems like Ayn Rand's opposition to Reagan was as a result of his pro-life position, because she was a staunch proponent of abortion, if I'm remembering.
Yeah, and also a supporter of keeping religion out of public life, or I guess in her view, just life in general. Yeah.
Cool. Good. So maybe we can shift gears a little
sure.
bit and talk about through some other things here. So I guess another partisan issue that we saw this year was that of voter ID laws.
Yeah.
And something that you've also written about.
Mm-hmm.
The left, of course, charges voter ID laws with being a tool for voter suppression, while the
yep.
right maintains a need for fraud-free
right.
elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about voter ID laws, and specifically, do voter ID laws seem to impact voter turnout or voter behavior?
So this is kind of a growing literature in a lot of different social sciences, and right now the evidence is kind of mixed. And so on the one hand, there's a lot of variance in state voter ID laws, ranging from Indiana's, which is the most restrictive, government-issued photo ID with an expiration date and a signature. And so in 2006, Congresswoman Julia Carson shows up to vote, has her congressional ID card. There's no expiration date because you are a member of Congress until you're not, and so she can't vote. And so, you know, in her, you know, for herself, you know, as a member of Congress. And so, but other states, you know, have really relaxed laws and don't have any requirements whatsoever. Other states make you sign in. And so there's a lot of variance. Not surprisingly, perhaps, to left-leaning listeners out there, states that have strong Republican legislatures are more likely to introduce voter ID laws and more likely to pass voter ID laws. And so that has occurred. The question is, does it affect voter turnout? On the one hand, folks without an ID are systematically way more likely to be Democrats than Republicans. These tend to be the elderly and African Americans especially, and also new immigrants to the United States. And so, on average, those groups tend to trend Democrat, or in the case of African Americans, are really strong Democrats. And so it's true that those groups in general are less likely to have an ID that a voter ID law would require. But there's also evidence that the thing that drives people to vote, you know, is largely an interest in politics and then the socioeconomic tools to express that interest at the polls. And so a lot of the groups that don't have an appropriate, from the government's point of view, ID, are also people who are not as inclined to vote in the first place. And so the real question is, do voter ID laws depress people's interest in politics and say, oh gosh, the state's trying to keep me down in another way, and so I'm not even going to bother, and even if I did, it wouldn't work out. And so we don't have great systematic evidence that suggests voter ID laws depress turnout. We have mixed evidence. In some cases, we find that it does at a marginal level, and in other cases, we find that it doesn't. But it's a hot issue, and it's going to become increasingly important as more and more states do it, and we'll be able to run more sophisticated tests about it.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I think we have another caller here on the air. So, caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Is that me?
Yep, it's you.
Yeah, I'm Jim. What I'm concerned about is the very idea of democracy, where all opinions are leveled to the sameness of numbers. And so what we get is politicians who speak to various groups, and no one really argues at the level of personal judgment. And if I want to elect somebody based upon what I understand of their ideas and personal judgment, I just can't find it in the media or in the politicians who run for office. And so I'm deeply disturbed about the value of our democracy.
Well, Jim, you are not alone. There is a lot of evidence that speaks to the point that you're making. The most recent and I think kind of the most fun evidence is that some folks, some communication scholars, examined the language used when members of Congress are making arguments on the floor in Congress. It averages at an 11th grade level, but members who associate with the Tea Party average at an 8th grade level. And so the newer members of Congress who have been swept into office are, as you suggest, making arguments that are less sophisticated and less intellectually stimulating. It's also the case that politicians, as you point out, kind of try to appeal to particular kinds of groups and tend not to make a broad, overarching argument about any particular issue that will be revealed to all voters at the same time. And so there's a lot of parsing out by demographics. The direct mail you get from a politician at your house will be necessarily different than the direct mail that your neighbor who is of a different gender or racial or ethnic background or age or something like that is going to be getting. And so the era of micro-targeting has depressed or lessened the quality of political debate and just the quantity of political debate and the availability of any, you know, pick your source of news media that does the same, because people can self-select into sources that already agree with their points of view. It's too hard in our society, though, to siphon yourself off from everything that might disagree with you, just given the how pervasive social networks are in our lives and that sort of thing. But it's much easier now to pick your information than it used to be, which also has something to do, I think, with what Jim is talking about.
Great. Thanks, Jim, for your comments. If you're just joining us on The Public Affair, we're talking with Dr. Michael Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, about elections, democracy, and media. Mike, I'd like to move to another partisan issue, if we can, to the issue of religion. You've done research related to Christianity and Islam. Is that correct? Or?
Published on Christianity, still working on other religions.
Okay, great. So I guess it would seem to me as a casual observer that religion plays a significant role in U.S. politics, mm-hmm. Whether it's on foreign policy, like the issue of Israel, or domestic policy and issues like gay marriage, abortion. But as someone who spent a lot of time actually researching these issues, what is the role of religion with regard to voter behavior?
It's really changed. It used to be that your denominational affiliation was reasonably strongly correlated with your vote choice. And so Catholics were concerned with social welfare and social justice, and so they supported Democrats, and and Protestants were more conservative with other issues and supported Republicans. And in the last 20 years, the shift has been not so much your denomination, but the veracity with which you believe, at least from the Christian point of view. And so whether you are, you know, a member of the non-doctrinal United Church of Christ or the Catholic Church or you're a Presbyterian or an evangelical, if you think the Bible is the literal word of God and is inerrant, and if you go to church a lot and if you pray a lot, regardless of your denomination, you're more likely to be a Republican. And if you think the Bible is a useful guide but not the divine word of God, maybe the inspired word of God, or even just a collection of stories, and you go to church less or not at all, but might be a member of some religious organization, you're more likely to be a Democrat. And so the religious traditionalist modernist divide has affected how religion matters in American politics. And in the work I've done, which is going around and talking to people in focus groups around the country in their churches or their atheist organizations or their synagogues or their or wherever they might meet, we find that the relationship is a little more complex, and people pick and choose when they want their faith to matter politically and when they don't. And a lot of it has to do with you know, how important particular kinds of issues are to them, and whether their church wants a public accounting. You know, some churches say you'll get your reward in the afterlife. It doesn't matter what happens on earth. And others say it's your job to make a better life on earth. And so depending upon what the church is asking their parishioners to do has something to do with how faith involves itself in politics.
Good. Great. Well, we have actually a couple callers on the line at this point, Mike. So let's go with the first one. Caller, if you could state your first name and your question.
Hi, yeah, that's me, and I'm not going to give you my name.
Okay.
I'd like to make a couple of comments. It's not in the religion sphere. I guess where I want to take the conversation a little bit is in the direction of actual representation of a wider breadth of viewpoints that the political parties don't represent. You know, we've had an election where people basically had to either vote for Obama or Romney. And, you know, it's become a world in this country where people are voting for the lesser of two evils rather than for someone who actually represents their viewpoints. And there's plenty of people who did support Obama based on his platform, and there's plenty of people who supported Romney based on his platform. But there's also a huge amount of people in this country. I mean, what did we have, like 5.5 or 6 million people vote? I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, it's gotten to the point now where people are voting frequently for the lesser of two evils because it's a two-party system. Someone like Jill Stein, Green Party, no one heard about her ideas and her platform. And there isn't discourse in election periods coming up to presidential elections on issues that are beyond the basic economic, health care, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that's one comment that I want to make that I would like, you know, you to bring into the conversation.
Sure, sure.
I guess I'll just stick with that one.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Mike.
No, that's a really important point. And so, you know, we start in our system. You know, as I think the caller sort of alluded to, we have a system that's set up to reward whoever gets past the post first, whoever gets 50.1% of the vote or more votes than the other person wins, and they win everything. And so, you know, Mitt Romney is not president of 48% of America. You know, he's nothing. It's over. He's lost his Secret Service protection already. You know, and so the parties have a really strong incentive to try to converge on people who are in the middle, which is really frustrating to people who don't live in the middle and have views that want to push the Democrats to be more liberal or push the Republicans to be more conservative, or might reject those labels outright and have their own set of attitudes about what it is that they want. And the system is not set up to help those voters get their preferences. And the system rewards the two-party system, and the parties make it very difficult for third parties to get on the ballot, to get to a debate, to be able to afford television advertising, and all of those things. And so the parties have a strong incentive to push these views out. And they have a strong incentive to do as little as possible to accommodate those views if they think that they're a threat. So if you could think back 12 years ago now to 2000, and Ralph Nader's run for the presidency was enough of a threat to the Democratic Party that they began to incorporate more Green Party issues into their platform in 2004 and 2008. Not in the way that the Green Party supporters would prefer, but enough to make Nader's candidacy in 2004 way less strong than it was in 2000 and non-existent since then in terms of the attention Green Party candidates get from the news media, from voters, and that sort of thing. And so it's just true that folks who want to push politicians and their elected officials or interest groups, you know, away from the middle and to be making some definite choices that would lurch the country in one direction or another are frustrated by what the founders gave us.
Sure, sure. Great. Thanks, caller. And we have another caller on the air. Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Yes, my name is Elaine. And I have a question about the effects of money. We're told that up to $1 billion was spent on either on both sides of the presidential election. And so I know that a lot of that money went to TV stations, to newspapers, other forms of media. But I need to understand where it goes after that. I would like to know what the guest thinks about following that money.
So money's given to candidates or to super PACs or is just spent by wealthy people who want to run their own super PAC. And most of that money goes to television stations to pay for their, you know, TV stations use that to pay for their programming. Some places have actually been able to add reporters in their newsrooms because they've made so much money from television advertising. One of the consequences is that companies that want to advertise their products are getting, you know, there's no oxygen because the politicians take up all of that air. But in terms of following the money, the Federal Election Commission follows what political candidates do pretty well, and there's a lot of reporting requirements for them. For super PACs, it's anybody's guess where that money goes, how they spend it, even who they are. They don't have to tell us who they are in the wake of the Citizens United decision. So it's really difficult to know where that money goes, and even for them, where it comes from, which is something that we at least know when it comes to politicians themselves and where they're getting their money. And so it's a different world. On the other hand, the super PACs that spent the most money didn't win any of the races that they were trying to win, and so money can't buy everything.
Right, right, great. And I think we have a thanks, Elaine, for that question. And we do have another call on the air. Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Yeah, my name is Walt, and my question is about statewide races. I just tuned in, so I'm not sure if you covered this or
not
if
yet.
It's part of the program. But
Go for it.
It seems like we've got a situation in Wisconsin that I'm hoping the federal situation will supersede in some cases, and I'm wondering about races around the country in different states in terms of statewide control.
In terms of money spent or...
In terms of, like, partisan control of the legislature or...
Right, and, how things are likely to go in Ohio and Florida and different other swing states where statewide control plays a role in the federal elections.
Yeah, statewide control of the legislature is most important in the year that ends in 8, because that's when they start to get ready for redistricting after the census in years that end in 0. And so those two elections are always really important because then lawmakers get to redraw the lines that elect lawmakers, which is kind of perverse in a lot of ways. And so those elections for state control tend to be really important, and Republicans had a lot of success in those last two, especially in the 2000 election and the 98 election in some degree at the state level, which helped them control redistricting, and the same in 2010. And so they've been able to protect Republican incumbents and put Democratic incumbents in more states at risk. And, you know, that's, you know, so there was a situation. So in Iowa, for example, there was a district where two Democratic members of Congress were drawn into the same district. So they had to run against each other, which, you know, has the consequence of eliminating one of them from Congress. And those sorts of things have really affected how federal politics works. And so it's been a pretty strong year from the Republican point of view in terms of electing governors and state legislatures. And this year hasn't been all that different.
Great, great. Do all states have similar redistricting?
They're very different. Some states, the majority party controls it. Some states, the governor appoints a commission, but usually that commission is weighted by one person to the governor's party. In other states, there's an independent commission that has an equal number of partisans, and so they have to come to an agreement. Oftentimes, the redistricting plan results in court cases. Mm-hmm. When there's a court case, that usually makes the next round of redistricting less partisan because they don't want the court to get to pick. But the laws vary widely, and the ones that work the best are laws where there's an independent commission with equal number of partisans and a prevention from a partisan source like a governor breaking a tie. Those are the states that have the most equitable redistricting outcomes.
Great. Thanks so much for answering that. Thanks for your call, Walt. If you're just tuning in, he's a public affair. We're talking with Dr. Michael Wagner, an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison about elections, democracy, and media. I want to shift a little bit, Mike, for the last few minutes here to talk about the events of Tuesday. And I have to say that you, like a few other pundits, were remarkably accurate in your predictions of the presidential election. You did tell me last weekend there was a good chance that Obama would get to 303, and sure enough, he did. And others, like the media forecaster Nate Silver, has been getting a lot of attention for his predictions. There's no doubt that media had a huge influence on this election, as they increasingly seem to with all elections. And on your recent post-election blog entry on ProWag, you pose a question to move us beyond the sort of gloating that can come with accurate predictions.
Sure. It's fun to gloat, but we should probably do more. Yeah,
I agree, but both are good. And that question is, how can journalists use what social scientists know to improve political news coverage? And so I'll maybe ask you some more specific questions, too. But in a general sense, how do you answer that question?
Well, the first way that I think about it is there are always the same bunch of stories that come up after an election, and they all have the virtue of having nothing to do with how governing works after the election, so it's sort of frustrating. And so a lot of stories now about President Obama's mandate. Liberals are certain that Obama has won a resounding mandate. Conservatives are saying the election was so close there can't possibly be a mandate. And if you really want to have some fun, go back and read Republican op-ed writers in 2004, and then read them again today. In 2004, as Bush has a wide-ranging mandate, and now Obama has no such mandate to speak of at all, and it's ridiculous to think about it.
Sure.
But the problem is that voting is a really blunt instrument. You don't get to vote Mitt Romney, cut taxes, outlaw abortion, but keep these elements of Obamacare that I like. You vote for Romney or Obama, and that's a blunt instrument, and so it's hard for anybody to know what anybody's vote means, even with exit polls. And so the existence of a mandate is something that we can't find evidence of when we look at how successful are presidents at enacting their legislative program in their second term or even in their first term. And you would think, well, maybe the size of victory matters. It doesn't matter. Maybe the number of states that they win matters. It doesn't matter. It's what matters is how the government is set up, and our government right now is a divided one. And the minority party is more than willing to use the filibuster in the Senate to stop the majority party from doing what they want to do. And so the existence of a mandate is not something journalists should be focused on. They should be focused on these tools of governing that Republicans and Democrats use to get things done. And so why are Republicans using the filibuster? Why did Democrats use it, or did they, in the same numbers, which they didn't, when they were in the minority? What do those, you know, tools have to say about how well democracy works? And if people are more aware of that kind of maneuvering, they might use their civic involvement more strategically to talk about those sorts of things. And so the search for a mandate or even an, you know, explanations, you know, in the coming days of why the president won are less useful than what's going to be the factors that help our lawmakers make compromises, which is required in a democratic system to move the country, you know, in a useful direction. So that, I mean, that's kind of how it starts. But there's also so many different kinds of things people can think about covering in terms of not just parsing people by race, but are there different societal needs in large cities versus medium-sized cities versus rural areas, or are there different kinds of problems? When we think about education, do we need to think about it similarly for the wealthy, the poor, whites and African-Americans and Hispanics and Asian-Americans and all these? There's lots of different kinds of stories that can tie those questions to how our government is set up and who the representatives are and which representatives represent large groups of people that are different than folks other groups, you know, represent. Those kinds of things, I think, would make for better media coverage.
Sure, great. And we do have another caller here, Mike. So, caller, could you state your first name and your question?
My name is Kurt.
Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Great topic, of course. But I just wanted to do, like, a call out to all creative people in Madison. I would like to see for future generations in elections a pictorial book, coffee table-sized book, that documents all the voter suppression techniques, from the billboards that were in Cleveland and in Milwaukee to the brochures that went out in the mail in Arizona telling the Spanish-speaking people that the election was on November 8th,
right,
to, you know, add in all those, but a pictorial book documenting this, because people forget so quickly about the techniques that are being used.
Well, and I think, you know, you could even push that a little farther and make it a pictorial book that also, you know, can play some audio, like, you know, you go to a greeting card store and you open up a card and it plays a little music. You could also play robocalls that say, you know, the election is on the wrong day, or you have to bring things that you don't have to bring with you, you know, to vote on election day. So there's a lot of suppression activities that you could photograph, which I think is a great idea. But there are other ones that you could record, and it would be really interesting to try to document all that stuff together. And also see, you know, in cities or communities where there were more of that, did we see a lower turnout as compared to places where there wasn't as much of that? That's a really important question that, to my knowledge, we don't have much purchase on, at least amongst academics. I think political activists see it pretty clear-cut, which is all the more reason people should investigate that as thoroughly as possible.
Great, great. Thanks so much for the comments, Kurt. We do have another call here. Caller, if you could state your first name and your question.
Okay, hi. Speaking of redistricting, in Iowa, I believe an independent legislative group commission redistricts every 10 years, and that seems to work pretty well. But in Wisconsin, there are one small town and one village about 10 miles north of Madison, DeForest and Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to be a part, and I think traditionally have been part of, total population is about 15,000. They were part of one legislative district. And the Republicans in control under Governor Walker redistricted them into three separate legislative districts. I mean, for two little tiny towns of about 15,000 total. And that sort of, you know, that sort of says it all and about what's wrong. But when it was legally contested, in fact, when redistricting was legally contested by the Democrats all over the state, the only districts, as you know, that were considered unfair were two, I believe, Latino districts in the Milwaukee area, or maybe in Milwaukee itself. And this is done, apparently, it's legally contested every 10 years by the party not in control, and usually the courts are much stricter than the most recent court decision. And I wondered if you could explain why this one allowed all these pretty outrageous, you know, totally bizarre, totally partisan changes to be made.
Right, so the Supreme Court has said that you can redraw districts to protect incumbents. And the court has also provided guidelines. One requirement for redistricting is that a district has to be contiguous, so every part of the district has to be touching. You know, you can't have, you know, like a, you can't ignore one city street and then jump back in. You have to be touching in some kind of way. And so sometimes map makers get really clever and follow an interstate corridor for a while and then go back. And so one district in Chicago called the Earmuffs District follows an interstate to hook together two groups of primarily Latino and Latina voters. And, you know, so redistricting typically is allowed to do those kinds of things. The most nefarious things that happen are what scholars call packing and cracking. And so if you have, let's say you want to have less Democratic members of Congress in your state, and let's say you have three districts, and one district, you got two that are currently Democrats, one where they win with 51% of the vote and one where they win with 53%. You might take a bunch of Democrats in the third district and just throw them all into those two Democratic districts, or into one of those districts. So now the Democrat will win with 80% of the vote, and then you take Democrats out of the other district where the Democrat was winning by 51. And so you pack a bunch of Democrats into one district so they win by a couple of touchdowns, and you take them out of the ones where they win narrowly, and then that improves how Republicans do in those districts. And so both parties do that whenever they have control of the legislature, and when a county or a community that is not larger than a district gets split in the way that the caller described, that has enormous consequences for policy representation. In some research I've done with John Winburn, we find that when counties get split, when there's no reason to split them, when they don't have more than 800,000 people living in the county, those counties get less attention from their member of Congress, fewer federal grants, and also show up less to vote because they don't know who their representative is, because their neighbor might have a different congressman. And so there is a bunch of negative consequences to that kind of redistricting.
Great. Thanks, caller, for your call. And we do have another caller here, Mike. Everybody is liking to talk to you, so that's a good thing.
Great.
Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Yeah, hello. My name is Methuselah. My question is this. It's always seemed to be a no-brainer that redistricting should be done by, not by politicians, but by, say, professional geographers.
Sure.
Or GIS specialists or demographers, and I know that's been proposed from time to time. I mean, it seems to me that that would be the best way of solving a lot of these disputes over the fairness of apportionment and reapportionment. Wondering what your guest feels about that idea of having it done by neutral professionals. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you.
Well, that's a great question, and it brings us back to the first question we were talking about, which was, you know, what's partisanship and where does it come from? And so the reason that that doesn't exactly happen is that members of both parties will immediately accuse the demographer of having a partisan affiliation. And so the way that redistricting works now, it actually, I mean, the GIS, the graphical interfacing system technology, you know, that kind of stuff, and the geographic kind of maps that the people who do redistricting use, they all use highly sophisticated systems and pay demographers to help them do it. And they help them generate, countless scenarios, and then they try to, where they're going to have an advantage, and then they try to pick the one that they think has the best chance of standing up in court. And so both sides are hiring demographers to run GIS, you know, mapping technology to put together districts. Some political scientists who study redistricting have a second income testifying in court cases for their party's side in whether those maps were fair and whether they violated various constitutional requirements for the drawing of districts. And so the problem, unfortunately, is that the parties won't agree on who the neutral demographer or neutral expert ought to be to help draw those districts. And so it's a matter of partisan politics gumming up the works once again.
Wow, that's fascinating. So, good. Well, we're nearly out of time here, Mike, but I guess I wanted to maybe start with the question that your work asks, and how well does democracy work?
Well, you know, I usually punt on that and say that, you know, I think Churchill was right. It's the worst form of government except for all the other ones. You know, and so, you know, I think that, you know, it's my view that the evidence shows that democracy generally works moderately well. And it generally works too slowly, and it generally has too many unintended consequences when progress is made. And so a lot of times the deal-making that occurs to make some sort of advance also requires changes that move us back in other kinds of areas. And so, but that's a function of, you know, we're a diverse people with a diverse set of interests, and our system is set up to require compromise. The founders made it really, really hard for any one ideological group to get control of the White House, the Supreme Court, and the Congress. And so change is necessarily and frustratingly slow.
Great. Thanks. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Mike, thanks for being here. Our guest has been Mike Wagner of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at W. Madison. You can read more about Professor Wagner at prowag.wordpress.com.